to air, to delete message, press 7 to save it in the archives, press 9 to hear more options, press 0.
What are you talking about?
All right, Erin, I have returned from my trip to Japan.
Welcome back.
Basically, I decided to co-opt this episode and make it all about my trip because I have been talking about it on this podcast for like, what, 8 months? I feel like it comes up in every episode and I've been trying to really restrain myself in order to like not absolutely bombard you with a zillion things. I decided to format our postcard today in the form of a postcard.
Ooh.
We're going to talk through all the little like sections in a postcard. Before I get into it, is there anything specifically on your mind that you wanted to ask me first? Because I've just jumped in immediately.
Well, there's first one question I need to ask you because I hear people talking about this a lot. Are you experiencing post-Japan blues?
Okay, great question. I don't think I'm experiencing the blues, at least not anymore. But I will say, like, the entire week after we returned home, I definitely was sleeping, like, all day.
That's just jet lag, though.
I mean, it could have been the blues. During it? It's hard to know because I was asleep the whole time.
Yeah, like, that's so funny. I see people talk about it all the time, about how they're just, like, especially sad when they come home from Japan.
I definitely really, really enjoyed the trip. And there's so many elements of it that I'm like, ugh, like, I just missed that. And it was so great. I'm happy to be home, though. But like, I have more thoughts that I want to dissect with you about this.
Okay.
But I'm leaving that for my surprising moment of the trip.
Okay.
First, let's talk about the first thing that you see on a postcard. That is the picture on the front. So I figured I would describe one image that I would use to describe the entire trip. But I'm curious what you would pick for your like postcard image on in Japan.
Ooh. I'm trying to think because I have sent postcards from Japan, but I don't have any of them. You have one, I think. Maybe not from Japan. I usually try to look for like artwork, like handmade postcards. And I feel like I usually just go for like pretty traditional postcard scenes, like of like a very famous, recognizable scene or like landmark. I don't know. I guess I'm a traditionalist with postcards.
Like a classic landmark.
People love it, you know? But I do like to find, like, I'm sure you're the same. I like to find unique ones, ones that like aren't mass produced because like they're just so beautiful usually.
If I was to send you a postcard that was to describe my entire trip in one image, it would be a piping hot pan of gyoza because, my God, I love dumplings. And dumplings to me are just like the heart of food. Like you eat it and you feel like you're being hugged. Mm. It symbolizes sharing, which I was doing the whole time with my special husband. I didn't realize how much I travel for food, truly. I can't tell you how many times I was so stoked to be eating. And gyoza is like my favorite food. So that's the picture on the front of my honeymoon postcard.
I love it. I really love gyoza as well. I'm a dumpling fan in general, too. Lucas and I always say this, like, especially on our last world trip, we were like, wow, there just really is a version of dumplings in so many countries. Like, especially on that trip, because we were going from country to country, we'd like arrive in a new place and there'd be like a different version of gyoza. We literally went from Japan to Nepal, and in Nepal, it was momos, which like also are dumpling, but like different. And it's just like cute to think that like humans love to make some version of dumplings like in so many places around the world. It's also when you think about them, they're such a communal thing to make. I've had like gyoza night, well, not gyoza, like dumpling night with my friends where we like make them from scratch and like fold them together. And it takes like so much time. So it's like
we've
very
done
social.
This together, haven't we?
I was thinking maybe we have. Yeah,
we have done this.
I love making dumplings. Like it's so much fun.
So obviously every postcard, every good postcard starts with a "I wish you were here" sentence, right? So I figured what was the moment that I wished Aaron was here or just thought about you having enjoyed this moment or something. And this goes back to me realizing how big of a food traveler I am. But man, I ate so many delicious things that all ended up being nut-free. And if I could like taste it for you and then give it the okay and then have you get to try it, I would be so happy because I had fatty tuna, of course. I had the whipped cream sandwiches that I know you still don't trust. And I'm like, you
trust I told Katie over text, like, it's just not my thing. They just don't look appealing to me.
Hook me up with a whipped cream sandwich with fruit
something
in it.
Like whipped cream and bread together. It doesn't make sense to me. It kind of scares me.
Honestly, whipped cream and fruit for me is just like top tier taste combination.
Yeah. It's just the bread that trips me up about it.
I want you to try them. But the most amazing thing that we had was we stayed at a private onsen ryokan. So we had our own little room in this beautiful kind of, I guess, like a onsen spa type hotel. But it was quite out of the way from, it was about like 30 minutes outside of Kyoto off of Lake Biwa. And so there wasn't like a lot of people there. And they had this like amazing farm to table dinner every single night that was just like, I don't know, 18 courses, like just lots of like little things all over the table, like little pickles and fish stuff and rice and all the amazing things that like to somebody with a food allergy, you would look at and be like, I'm not eating any of this because I have no idea what any of this is. And I feel like I'm not sure. And so it was like totally safe for me the whole time. I got to eat so much fresh fish. We had Wagyu 3 nights in a row, which was like insane. It was a total surprise to us because we had no idea what we were in for with this dinner. And so I just wish you were at all of these food, like all the ice creams I ate. I want you to eat all those ice creams too.
Like, oh, for people who don't know, I just like don't eat ice cream because there's always a risk of peanut cross contamination. Yeah, I would love like a matcha ice cream. Oh my gosh.
Just know I was eating in your honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I will say in my experiences in Japan, I have definitely been able to be more adventurous there than other countries, which is great. Even when I like can't be adventurous in Japan, the options that I have are still always so good. I've had like just such great food there. Like,
yeah. No. Okay, so the body of this postcard is really the main message. Like, what is it that I'm excited to tell you about? So I was putting together, what is the highlight of the trip? Because everyone keeps asking me this, like, what was the highlight? What was the one thing that like really stood out to you? And it's like kind of impossible to even say. But there was a couple of standout days that, you know, those days when you're traveling and everything just goes right. Like even like you're thinking ahead a little bit and you're like, oh, and if the timing works out, we'll just maybe grab that if we have time. And then you have time. We had that when we went to the beach one day. We went to a beach outside of Fukuoka and took like a 30-minute bus ride out there. And the beach was beautiful and the water was crystal clear and it wasn't very populated because it was just outside of the main city. And the bus had like amazing views on the way there. It was so beautiful. So we spent like most of the day on the beach. And then there was supposed to be a hike that was Totoro themed from My Neighbor Totoro. So we had to walk through the little village that was next to the beach and then get to the hike. So we walked through the village and we were like, actually, we're feeling a little peckish. So like, where can we stop and get lunch? So we look over and there's like a seafood restaurant there. We're like, okay, obviously it's going to be great, but we don't need anything big. Like we don't need to spend all this money, but like, let's just go and see what we can get. And then it was like a grill your own seafood place. And we did not expect this. We ended up ordering like a kilo of oysters that were the size of my entire hand and just had no idea what we were even getting up to. And they had like this place, there was so much sizzling seafood at everybody's table. They had jackets that you could wear so you don't like
to get protect seafood. Yourself.
You protect yourself. Because like these oysters would like, you just put them over the flame. And then as they cook, they just open on their own and then you can scoop out the oyster. Some of them would kind of explode. And it was just like the funniest, most delicious little lunch that we had that was like totally, we didn't even know that this was a thing. So we ended up doing, we walked over to the hike and then we were like, okay, now we have to like walk to the bus stop. And there was a little bar on the way. We had one beer each. And then we kept walking to the bus stop and we were like, oh, we've got like 6 minutes until the bus comes. Do we have time to have a pee and grab an ice cream before we get on the bus? And we did. And we barely had to wait for the bus and we had the best day. It was like one of those amazing days.
What I'm hearing is like a simple day is sometimes the best day because it's not like you did that much. And this is what I find too. It's like the days that like are just very simple end up being really memorable. Yeah.
Like our plan was the beach. We go to the beach and then we just make sure we don't miss the last bus.
Yeah. I think I told you like our philosophy, especially in Japan, is to only have one thing we have to do that day. So we'll be like, today we will visit this temple. And that is the only concrete plan. And then you just fill in the rest of the day because you will find ways to fill in the rest of the day.
I was just going to say, like, making one plan per day is actually quite a difficult exercise in, like, restricting yourself.
Yeah.
Like, it's really difficult to do that. And especially in the era of, like, online content where, you know, just the FOMO is so real now. Like, people make you feel like you're really missing out on something. It can be really hard not to overplan and just, like, completely exhaust yourself.
Wait, did you guys go to, I can't pronounce it, I think it's called the Dajingu Shrine in Tokyo. It's the Love Temple.
No, we didn't.
Oh, I was wondering if you would, because it's, like, tradition if you're on your honeymoon to go there. Because it's like a matchmaking shrine. So people will go there and like wish for love. And then if you have love, it's like good luck to go there. I feel like it's a lesser known shrine, but I should have told you. I definitely like thought at some point, oh, they need to go to the shrine. But yeah.
Dang. Well, I will say our shrine and temple visits were not as frequent as I think most people's Japan trips look like.
Hmm.
Like, we didn't visit too many, and it wasn't until the end of the trip that we were like, oh, now we're kind of feeling a different way after we had, like, spent time learning more about the cultures and the religions and everything. Then we started to feel a little more connected to it.
Wow, that's so funny, because we have been to a wild amount of temples and shrines in Japan. We love them.
I was so surprised. Like, I genuinely thought we were going to end up visiting way more, and they just, like, whenever we were figuring out our itinerary for the day, like, they just didn't really come up. Or if they were near something else that we wanted to do, we would go and visit that. We went to a baseball shrine.
Here's a tip that I feel like a lot of people don't know, because everyone knows all the famous, like, most cities have, like, famous temples and shrines you go to. But there are actually so many. Like, if you search at any point in your day, you will find one to visit. So we just tend to go to like ones that are just on our route every day that you can just kind of walk into that aren't like attractions, quote unquote. But we also love our Goshuin books. So we're also motivated to go to them to collect stamps.
This is the thing. You can't help but compare your trip to others. But when I see other people traveling to Japan, it seems like people are just consistently always at shrines. And I don't know. It's just... I don't know.
It just wasn't your vibe. We love them. Here's why we love them. I would say we love the ones outside of cities the most. Like when we were in more rural parts of Japan, we really enjoyed them because they're so quiet and peaceful. And we just love to sit and watch people. Like, it's just such a space to like sit down and just like disconnect and just take in what's going on around you. I think that's why we love them so much, because it was just a place to just see people coming and like practicing something that's very special to them. I don't know, something about just taking that in and observing that we really love. And they're so peaceful. And when you do go to shrines like in Tokyo or like Osaka, they're like quiet spaces within the city. And I love that contrast of like, it depends which one you go to. If you go to like a really famous one, it's not going to be quiet in there. But like this love shrine I'm telling you about, like it was a very quiet one. So it was just a cool contrast to go from like the bustling city into this like more quiet, reflective space. I think that's what I love about them. Yeah.
I was trying to figure out what was the most surprising moment. Nothing really disappointed me, to be honest.
I actually have a question on this note, because it's very difficult not to consume a lot of content about Japan before you go these days. So I'm curious if there were any ideas, expectations, assumptions that you had about what it would be like, about what the trip would be like, about the culture, the food. Were there any assumptions that you had that ended up feeling different when you were there in real life? Was it what you thought it would be based off of everything you consumed?
I would say for the most part, it was everything that I thought it would be. But understanding that what I thought it would be, I was also cautiously optimistic with some stuff. I'm curious if there was anything that you thought I would be surprised by.
Ooh, good question. I thought that you might be surprised by how different, and this isn't Japan specific, but how different the experience of travel would be in total, because it was your first time traveling to Asia and traveling beyond like Europe and North America, which can be quite different. And so I was like, ooh, I wonder how that'll go for them, because I wouldn't say that Japan is like challenging to travel, but it's definitely like involves more logistics than traveling in Europe or like anywhere around North America. So that I was curious about, like how you would find adjusting to that.
I found I feel like I adjusted in a very positive way. Like I can't help but compare, because I've traveled around Canada so often, just how accessible it is to get anywhere. There's bus routes and trains literally everywhere. And the bus routes and trains are like organized really well. I was really, the most nervous about was definitely navigating like the transit system and all the trains and stuff like that. And it was a little tricky at first, but then eventually you get the organizational flow of it. And you're like, oh, every single station has a number. They all have a letter line, so you know if you're going the right way or the wrong way, if the numbers are going up or down. There is a special area to stand, so you know you're getting on the right train, basically on the markings on the floor. And then there is a local train that stops at all of the stops. There's a rapid train that stops at only a few of the major ones. And then there's a semi-rapid train. And like once you get the flow for that, and then you can see all the signage, it's actually really easy to navigate the system. And the only tricky part is like sometimes going from a train to a bus. But I was very surprised by how confident I felt by the end of the trip, being like, oh, I know exactly where we're going.
Yeah. Like, I will say, I think I told you this when we chatted before, but it has gotten a lot easier to travel in Japan. During the Tokyo Olympics, they added a lot more signage. They just like tried to make the country a little, especially Tokyo, but other parts of the country as well, a lot more like quote unquote foreigner friendly. Like when I was there in 2017, it was so much harder. Like in 2024, when we were there, we were like, it is a completely different experience to travel here now. You couldn't even get a SIM card as a foreigner in 2017. So we were walking around Japan without any internet connection.
Yeah, I don't know how you would have done that. Like yeah. We were fully reliant on Google Maps like the entire time.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, like Google Maps is so good now. Like it tells you like exactly what exit to take out of each station. It's just like so detailed now. It's so much easier.
Yeah, I don't envy your 2017 experience.
I'm glad I had it, because I feel like so few people experienced that. I'm sad that I didn't go to Japan in like 2010. Like I would have liked to go earlier, but I am happy that I had my 2017 experience, because it was very different from 2024 for sure. And it was fun. Like every day was kind of just an adventure because we were literally every day was just us trying to figure things out. We were more forced to like ask for help too. I just need to share this like one tidbit from this trip. It was 2017. We just flew into Tokyo. All we had was instructions on how to get from the airport to the neighborhood we needed to get to Oimachi Station. And then we had the address of the place we were staying in Oimachi. But the address was written in English. This is key information. So we get off the train at Oimachi Station. We're really proud of ourselves because we're like, we did it. We got to the station. It's easy from here on out. We leave the station. All the signs are in Japanese, of course. We don't have the Japanese translation of the address we're going to. So we literally have no idea where to go. So we're just standing around and eventually we're like, well, we have to ask someone for help. And we're right by the train station. So, and everyone after work, like a lot of people, they go back to their home train station and then they eat like around the train stations because there's lots of good food around train stations. So of course we ran into this group of businessmen, just these young business guys. They've clearly had some drinks and they are very happy to help us, but they don't speak any English. And they look at the address and they're like, we don't know what that is. And we were in the street with these guys for like 45 minutes because they would not let us walk away. They were like, we are going to figure out where this is. And they were like Googling things, trying to translate. Like it was 2017. We didn't have all these translation apps like we do today. And yeah, I just always laugh about that because we'd literally been in Japan for like 2 hours. And we were already on the street with these guys, just like laughing, trying to figure out like what this English address was. And I remember that being like the core problem when we were in Japan the first time. Like even when we had Google Maps, everything was in English, but then signage would be in Japanese, which was like useless to you because you're like, I have the street name, but the sign is in Japanese. So I don't know if this is the same street.
Were the guys finally able to help you or they lingered around?
Yeah. I think what happened is they called the place for us. We had like a phone number and then they walked us there.
One surprising moment that I wanted to talk to you about was honestly since I got home and I've been like really wrestling with this idea of like romanticizing the trip. And there's a whole bunch of people that I know that are traveling right now and they're like, oh, why is it not like this back home? And oh my gosh, like they just seem to do everything right. And I still can't get over like the intentionality that I feel around Japanese culture that seems to be missing from like North American culture. Like it just feels like there's a lot of effort and respect that goes into treating humans with like dignity in some capacity, at least on the like surface level. And then, you know, when you talk to more people who live there and they give you sort of more background into the economy and how rough it actually really is for a lot of people behind the scenes. And, you know, like there's a reason why there aren't a lot of unhoused people on the streets in major cities. Like a lot of them are in jail or, you know, there's all this stuff. So this is the thing that I keep coming back to when anybody's like, well, how amazing was it? What's the big thing like that you should talk about? I'm like, in the back of my head, it's all thinking, you know, there's bad things happening in the background. And then it's the case in every single country. And so I don't know. I'm just curious, like, where does your head go when you're trying to figure out like what to do with those feelings and bringing things back home that you're like, oh, like this just makes sense to have back in my society. And then otherwise you're like, well, there's like repercussions to all the actions that governments make and stuff like that. I'm just curious what you think.
Well, you're right to say that this happens with really any country. This isn't like uncommon for me to hear people like who've come back from a trip and they have a lot to say about like everything that the country they visited is doing right. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think like it's a human thing to compare like your experience abroad to your experience at home and like take notice of the things that are potentially better in that place. I think like what I worry about is that romanticizing or idealizing a place can, like you mentioned, like mean that we overlook the realities and the challenges of that place because it is a fact that, like, while Japan does a lot of things very well, I'm very jealous of their transportation system. They do have a lot of challenges as well, like social and economic challenges. And I think what happens is, like, when people go for, like, a couple weeks, they're there within a specific context that isn't conducive to understanding, like, the quote-unquote underbelly of a place. Like,
yeah.
You really have to live somewhere to start to experience those things. And I know you and I have, like, both talked. We have a friend of the podcast who has lived in Japan for years. We both hung out with him in Japan, and he told us all about, like, the more difficult aspects of living in Japan. And a lot of it, I think what a lot of people notice about Japan is, like, the collective ideology of, like, life there. People are just more collective and less individualistic. And you can really feel that. And it feels so different from, like, what we experience here. But there are definitely, like, downsides to that that you don't feel when you're a visitor.
Something interesting we came across was they're going through an election period of some kind. And so we were seeing a lot of signs for the Japanese Communist Party. And it's just interesting seeing, like, what's on the ballot compared to back home. And so one of the things that they were fighting for was, like, time off.
Like, yeah.
People shouldn't be working all of the time. Mm-hmm. But then they also had tax the billionaires signs and no war signs. Like, so there is stuff that's very familiar to home. And then you're like, oh, there's, like, a pretty significant cultural difference between, like, at least we get weekends and, like, days off.
Yeah.
So it's, like, so interesting to see the political side of it too.
Yeah. This is the other thing I notice about, like, idealizing Japan that, like, really bothers me is, like, people who talk a lot about how quote unquote cheap it is there. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just so much commentary around that. And I take so much issue with it because it just shows that, like, you're unaware of what's actually happening there. Like, there is an economic crisis happening in mm-hmm. Japan. Like, the economic conditions for, like, residents in Japan are not good. And, like, when something is super affordable for you coming from another country, that usually means, like, people on the other end are struggling to some degree. And those are, like, some of the problems that I think people overlook a lot is, like, wages have been stagnant in Japan for years. The yen has weakened. They have an aging and shrinking population, which is why, like, their economy isn't doing so well because they have less working age people. That might also explain, like, the overworking that happens. So, yeah, it's like all of this stuff is going on, but you wouldn't know it if you're just visiting for 3 weeks. This is exactly why I think it's so important to, like, research and read about places. Yeah.
And do this podcast.
But we're lucky because we also, like, I feel like I know more about Japan just from being friends with Tommy because we've talked so much about it. Yeah.
Same. Well, so on that note, I didn't want to leave it in an existential crisis mode. So I was thinking about some things that I saw in Japan that I was like, these are things that you could actually try and implement in your community if you wanted to. One of the things that was interesting for me to learn about was Tenji blocks. They're like yellow blocks on the road that are either lined or with dots. And travelers often complain about them because they're really hard to roll your suitcases on. But they are a Japanese invention. And it was invented by a guy named Saichi Miyake in Okayama. And he just invented this sidewalk system because a friend of his was going visually impaired and he just really cared about his friend. And so he presented it to the Okayama Blind Association, and it was pretty soon installed just around the School for the Blind in Okayama. And then eventually it was spread worldwide. It took about 25 years for this to be, like, really, really widespread. And it's a very simple technology that, like, literally any municipality in Canada or wherever you live could probably just start implementing. So if something you care about is, like, making the world more accessible and, you know, making it easy for people who are visually impaired to navigate the world, then, like, this is something you could easily advocate for in your own backyard. It's like Braille for the road. So it's, like, really cool. I've seen them in Toronto, But I haven't seen them so much in like more rural areas. And so there might be a lot of towns that in Canada mm-hmm. that just like don't have this type of thing. And they just
Have them in Toronto, but they're not as
they're not yellow in Toronto.
No, but they're also not as detailed, I guess. Like I feel like they only appear at intersections in Toronto. Yeah.
They're the most common at intersections for sure, but we noticed them in all of the train stations. Most of the major roads that we were on all had this going on, and it was like just cool. At first, I don't know what even led me to discovering this, but it was just something I learned randomly, just a fun tidbit mm-hmm. that I was like, oh, cool. And then also if you care enough, like you could also advocate for privacy stalls and, you know, rainforest sounds in every bathroom, because that is just nice. Like, why don't we have that everywhere? I don't understand.
Like, oh, yeah.
That's a simple thing you can advocate for in like your neighborly bar or something. And just start small.
Yeah, you just like made me remember how in both South Korea and Japan, I noticed panic buttons in bathroom stalls. Did you notice this? And at one point I was like, Luke, like, are you seeing these? Is this just in like women's washrooms, or like, are these all washrooms? And I think he said that they were in the men's washrooms as well, that there were basically buttons you could press, like if you needed help for any reason. And I also remember sometimes bathroom stalls would have like a notice that if you were in there for longer than like 10, 15, 20 minutes, there would be like a time it would list that someone would come and check on you.
Oh my God. The bathroom accessibility was really impressive. Like, I also noticed that in all the stalls, there was a little like seat where you could put a kid. And I asked Mark, I was like, is this just in the women's bathroom or is this in the men's? And he's like, it's in all the men's stalls, this little seat. Also, there was in any just like mixed bathroom, like the little bathrooms, I appreciated that there was a sign in everyone that was like, please sit on the toilet. We don't want like your spray everywhere. Please keep the bathroom clean. It was like, sit on the toilet.
But you know what? Like, this all goes back to the collectivism piece. Like, public spaces are designed to be good for everyone. I will say that not all of Japan is like this. This is where I find like people do tend to like generalize, right? Like in urban places, like, yes, the public washrooms are like that. But if you go beyond like the famous urban spaces and go more into like rural parts of Japan, like don't have the expectation that you're going to have an amazing stall everywhere you go. But I just love like personally, I mean, I talk about this all the time, but I just love countries that care about like public transport infrastructure, and Japan truly does it best. Like, it's probably the best country I've ever been to for that. And it's not just like trains, like the buses are incredible. Did you notice that vehicles like cars, they're usually only ever white, gray, or black?
Now that you mention it.
No, I've told people this before and they don't tend to notice it until you say it. But yeah, something like 80% of all the vehicles in Japan are either, most of them are white, or they're black or silver. And I looked it up because I was curious when I noticed this. And it's because it simplifies manufacturing, like it's more efficient to mostly produce these three colors. And then for resale value.
That must be the same reason for all the umbrellas being either clear or black. Yeah,
probably. Our joke about the clear umbrellas, though, was that like we were there in the rain often because we were there in the spring, and you'd like go into a restaurant or a shop and you'd put your clear umbrella in. And then when you left, you'd have no idea which one was yours. So you would just take one. And we were always joking. We were like, how many umbrellas do you think we've actually had? Like, is this the original umbrella, or are we like six umbrellas deep?
I was literally talking to somebody about this exact thing. And they're like, well, how do you know which one is your umbrella? And I'm like, it doesn't matter.
They're all the
they're
same.
They're all the same umbrella.
Yeah.
Communal perspective. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's mainly the meat of my postcard. I had one last PS that I wanted to shout out, because I did mention that we went to this beautiful onsen that had the amazing dinner where we had Wagyu three nights in a row. And like, that is a lot to proclaim. And the reason we were able to do that was because we saved up enough scene points, which is a Canadian point system that ended up, there was a scene and Expedia combination thing. And so we ended up getting this beautiful place. But I didn't realize that it was actually a place in a town that not a lot of people were visiting. And it took me out of the major tourist areas. And it was mostly actually locals visiting this place. And so it was really nice. I didn't expect to, like, because, you know, on Expedia, you don't really necessarily expect to get like a individually owned hotel place. But we did. And we had an amazing 3-night stay that went like over and above what we totally expected outside of all major tourist areas. We were able to relax. So I'm not trying to shell out credit cards here, but like, this is just your like annual reminder to check how many points you've collected in anything and see if you can use them towards travel, because travel in this economy is a different level these days. So That's all I had to say about that. That's my PS statement.
Yes, as long as you are a responsible credit card user.
Exactly. Do not get more credit cards just for the sake of that.
I have a whole like credit card churning strategy for collecting points that I will fill you in on.